is to calculate the primordial spectrum as predicted by inflation. And basically the calculation is like, well, as we all do it, it's like climbing Mount Everest. So it consists of several steps. So we'll be practicing going up and down until hopefully tomorrow, the last lecture, we'll make it to the base camp 4, well, camp 4, and then we climb all the way to the primordial spectrum. So yesterday we just made it to the base camp by considering the quantization of time-dependent Hamiltonian. So today I am hoping to reach number one, continuing this thing here, but now actually really telling you what is special about the time-dependent frequency. So hopefully we'll make it to the camp one today. Okay, so time-dependent harmonic oscillator. And so the action is just the simplest thing, dt 1/2 q dot square plus minus omega square, which now can depend on t, and then q square. And of course, this is the Hamiltonian, this is the Lagrangian for our action. And so what we did is that we expanded the solution. So of course, this defines the equations of motion, and we expanded the solution to these equations of motion in terms of some basis solution f. And so we have a solution which can be written like af f of t and af dagger f prime of t. These af are some constants, which basically tells you a linear combination of two independent solutions. So where f is a solution to equation of motion coming from this Lagrangian here. And so we have chosen such solution that it is normalized. So normalized so that f and f equals to 1 with respect to the symplectic product. It's so with respect to symplectic product, which is defined as if you have two solutions, F1 and F2, this is just given by F1 star. And now just let me write it in this way, dt F2. And then this dt can act either on right and minus acting on left. So sometimes people use this notation. And then I'm telling you, this is expressed at t equal to 0. But in some sense, what you are writing down on the right-hand side is a Wronskian. And you can show that it's time independent. So actually, provided that you really have two solutions, this quantity here will be the same for all times. Okay, and so that's the advantage of this scalar product, if you want. Okay, so this is the classical solution, but of course you can quantize it. And if you quantize it, then the only thing which happens is that Q is now an operator, A is an operator, AF is an operator. And so quantization promote everything to operators, impose the canonical commutation relations between Q and P. And then you can define the vacuum. And you can define excited states with n particles, if you want, n of f. And then you have an important operator which measures how many particles are in a given state. And it's just given by af dagger af. OK. So this is all very, very standard. So now what is maybe surprising is that here, I haven't chosen these states f, as you may be familiar is like exponential e minus I omega t. Okay, I haven't chosen that. I just told you this is some convenient full set of solutions in some sense, which is normalized, but it doesn't have to be e to minus I omega t. And in fact, I'll show you that that actually can be done only if your Hamiltonian is time independent. Okay, so what it means is that this basis actually is not preferred anyhow, in some sense, and you can choose another basis, choosing different basis. Let me call it G. So, of course, G is again a solution of my equation of motion. So, I should be able to expand it again in terms of the other things. So now the coefficients of expansion are called alpha and beta. So alpha f of t and beta f star of t. But these coefficients are famous coefficients, are called Bogoliubov coefficients. And so this basis is, you know, equally good, and you can again introduce annihilation and creation operators, but now with respect to this basis. And surprisingly, provided that this beta is non-trivial, then actually the observers who sees vacuum in one basis doesn't see vacuum in other basis, meaning sees some particles. And specifically, I've shown you that if you take vacuum for the basis F, and then you take the particle number operator in basis G, then this is equal to beta squared. And what it really tells you is that particles are sort of ambiguous. Which means that they depend on the concrete observer. Okay? Are there any questions to this? So I think this is all pretty clear. So now, let me discuss one more subtlety, and that's precisely when you can choose the basis to be e exponential of minus I omega t, in some sense. And so you may be asking, so if you are defining a vacuum, of course we are defining it as a state where there are no particles, in a given basis for a given observer. But you may be asking, is this vacuum actually a state which is the lowest energy you can have? So naturally you would like to have vacuum to be the lowest energy state in some sense. So the question is, you know, is vacuum lowest energy state? And you probably know the answer. What do you guess? Is it? Not necessarily. Okay. And so for this, to answer this question, let me just consider what are the eigenstates of Hamiltonian. Okay. So eigenstates of Hamiltonian. And so, first, what is my Hamiltonian? So, Hamiltonian is just given by the Legendre transformation of the Lagrangian. So, it's PQ dot minus L. PQ dot minus L. And so, it's just the energy as you would expect. So, just the minus sign changes to plus sign. So, it's just given by 1/2 P square and then 1/2 Q square omega square T. And of course, that depends on time as well. So we have time-dependent Hamiltonian. Now what you can do is that you can plug in your solution. So we have the solution is Q as A times F plus A dagger F star. So let's plug it in. Okay. So of course, P, I showed you yesterday, is just Q dot. So you just take a dot of that equation there. So you have 1/2, and then a f f dot plus a f dagger f star dot square, and then plus 1/2 a f f plus a f dagger f star square, and then omega square. So this is what it is. And then you can expand it, putting all the terms, you know, basically expanding things and putting terms which have AF and AF together, and then AF dagger and AF dagger together, and so on. Okay. So then the result is, and hopefully this is correct, I'll just copy it from here, but you can probably check it immediately. So we have F dot square plus omega square F square standing in front of AF and AF. And then we have F dot square plus omega square F square standing in front of AF dagger and AF dagger. And then you will have mixed terms when there's one AF and one AF dagger. And this should be F dot square plus omega square F square, and then you have AF, AF dagger, and the other term as well, AF dagger, AF. Okay, so we just expanded these things. Okay, so now you may be asking the simplest question. So not, we are asking the question about the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, but let's be very specific and let's ask about the vacuum. Okay, so now let's apply this Hamiltonian to the vacuum H0F, and then let's be asking, and this is really an eigenstate of the vacuum. Okay, so there's some corresponding eigenvalue of the vacuum. So now you just take this formula here, apply it to the vacuum, and of course if you apply it to the vacuum, then this term cancels because it's just annihilates the vacuum. Okay, this term cancels because it annihilates the vacuum, but we have the remaining two terms. Okay, so H acting on 0F is just given by this term here, f dot square plus omega square, and then af dagger, acting on the vacuum, and the other term, which is f dot square plus omega square, and then acting on the vacuum. And of course, if you create and then you annihilate, you just get back the vacuum. Okay, so this is the result of the calculation, and now you see the trouble. So actually, the vacuum is not an eigenstate of your Hamiltonian, provided that this term is non-trivial, because of course this describes a state with two particles, and so you cannot have, it's not proportional to the vacuum state. Okay, so in order, the vacuum was where an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, you have to kill this term. So this guy has to be equal to zero. And then I have the eigenstate. So now this seems as a trivial condition, but it's actually very, very restrictive. So I'm setting this guy equal to zero, and it has, of course, I can take the square root here, and it has two solutions. So from here, I would conclude that f dot is plus minus I omega f. Okay, so that's the condition I'm imposing, so that really the vacuum is an eigenstate of H. At the same time, I have to satisfy the equation of motion, which of course just reads f double dot plus omega square f equals to zero. So that's the equation of motion following from my Lagrangian here. Okay, so now let's play with these conditions. So in particular, let's differentiate this, the first one with respect to time. So then you are getting f double dot. So from here, f double dot is equal to, and now omega depends on time. So you have plus minus I, and then you have omega dot f plus omega f dot. Okay, and then for f dot, you can plug in again this thing here, and you can use your equation of motion. So what it should give you is something like minus omega square f, and then plus minus I omega dot f. Okay, so now this guy equals to that guy is your equation of motion. So this guy must be equal to zero. That's your requirement for the vacuum to be an eigenstate of your Hamiltonian. So in other words, this is zero only if omega dot is equal to zero. So if omega is equal to a constant. So that's something, you know, trivial, but so really what I'm saying here is that the vacuum can be an eigenstate of your Hamiltonian, of course, only if actually you have time independent frequency. And only in this case you can actually choose the preferred set of modes which you are familiar with. So if omega equals to constant, then you can take this equation here and you can integrate it. So you have f dot over f is a constant. So of course logarithm of f is I omega t, and that gives you your familiar basis. Okay, so then if this is true, then f of t, and I'll put a normalization here to omega so that my f and f, the scalar product equals to 1, is e. And then I'm choosing the minus sign by convention. So you will call this state, so you have two solutions, of course, that corresponds to f and f star. And I'm choosing f to be with the minus sign, and I'll call this positive frequency mode. And then if you have plus, you will call it negative frequency mode. Okay, so but only if omega equals to constant, you can choose the basis as you know it. And in some sense, this is you know, trivial. So you can basically write your mode, and this is true in general. You can always write like a constant times the corresponding coordinate, only if that coordinate is a killing vector of your space-time or whatever. So only if I have time independent, only if I have time independent oscillator, I can. Actually, the energy is conserved, and so this is expressed by the fact that I have conserved quantity times the corresponding coordinate. Okay, so we have seen that in when we were separating variables for Klein-Gordon equation or Hamilton-Jacobi equation and so on. So only if you have the conserved quantity, only if you have that killing vector, then you can do the simple separation of variables. You can write it in this form. Okay. Very good. So only if omega equals to constant you have that mode. If it's not, then whatever I have written here is still true. But simply f has to be something much more complicated, right, than this thing here. And in that case, your vacuum is not only the lowest energy level, but it's not energy level, and it's not eigenstate of energy at all, if omega is not a constant. Okay? So I just wanted to stress this thing here. Are there any questions to this? If not, then let's consider a special case of whatever is happening here, which is, however, of particular interest, and that's called in and out states. So oftentimes it happens that if you are plotting how your, so this is my time, and how your omega of t looks like, is that in the infinite past, so as t goes to minus infinity, you get something which is really a constant there, and you call it omega m, and it's constant. And in the infinite future, you have omega out, again, a constant, and some non-trivial dependence on time just happens in between. Okay, so this is a typical situation, of course, for scattering problems and stuff like that. Okay, so now if this is the case, then you can define two preferred set of modes. So one of them is in modes, and these are simply the modes which when you go to infinite past, they just behave as these preferred states here. Because now omega is equal to constant, so I have these preferred states. So in modes are such modes where limit t goes to minus infinity of my in mode is just that preferred thing. So it's 1 over 2 omega in, and then e to minus I omega n times t. Okay, and of course the out mode will be precisely the analog in the future. So the out mode are such that limit limit t goes to plus infinity f out of t is 1 over t omega out e minus I omega out times t. Okay, so these are just preferred set of modes. Actually, I'm using the fact that here omega is a constant and here omega is a constant. However, notice here that the way I define this is that the in mode actually is a solution, and the out mode is a solution for every time. So the only requirement is that as you go to infinite past or infinite future, it behaves certain way. But anyway, it's a solution for all times. These are solutions for all t. Okay, that, however, means that I can use f in as one of my bases and f out as another basis. So actually, f in now plays the role of f, and f out plays the role of t. Okay, so that means that actually I can relate these two solutions by the Bogoliubov transformation. So you can write f out as alpha times f in plus beta times f star in. Okay. And because now this is sort of like a scattering problem, if you want, so you are sending something in the infinite past. Yeah. Oh, this is always Heisenberg picture.
Yeah.
So I have really, yeah. Okay. So because this is something like a scattering problem, I'm thinking about something, you know, which wasn't interacting in the infinite past, and it's not interacting in the infinite future, but it's sort of like there's some interaction in the middle. So these Bogoliubov coefficients are something like, so this is Bogoliubov again, but it's something like the S matrix, if you want, for your scattering problem. Okay. Okay, so now you can use, let's say, the in mode, and you know, define all that machinery over there, and so you can define the corresponding vacuum for the in mode. Okay, and of course, the vacuum is defined as the A in acting on that vacuum gives you zero. So that vacuum in the infinite past actually has no particles in it.
So is it right to say that at every point in time, the Hamiltonian has a different vacuum?
Every time in time, the Hamiltonian.
Point in time, the Hamiltonian has a different vacuum.
Well, the question is, what do you mean by vacuum, right? So if you're asking about the lowest energy state, that will be changing. The state will not change. So the vacuum, as we define it here, is simply not the, you know, it's not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So now if you are asking about the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, I think they are not really interesting in that sense. Because, you know, you'll be seeing different number of particles, or not really even, you cannot define even number of particles for those states or whatever. Yeah, so it's, yeah. So we prefer to call vacuum something which doesn't have particles, rather than, you know, it behaves nicely under, you know, the Hamiltonian, but you know, because the Hamiltonian is time dependent, and it's a problem. Yeah. Okay, so in particular, you can define the in vacuum, vacuum as a in zero in equals to zero. And that's a vacuum which is empty in the past. However, in future, in some sense, it contains the following number of particles. So you have zero in, and then you are applying now the out state, or the, so now you'll be using the out basis and the corresponding number operator. So n out, and then you are asking what happens here. And because this is just a special case of whatever we had here, it's just given by beta square. Okay, so this is just given by beta square. So in some sense, what we have just described here is a particle creation by time-dependent Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is a particle creation. So really, if you have time-dependent Hamiltonian, then the number of particles in the infinite past will be different to the number of particles in the infinite future. Okay? So now this looks all very abstract, so I'll do a concrete example. And still, you know, staying in the realms of quantum mechanics, and then you will elevate that example to the level of quantum field theory tomorrow in your tutorial. So you'll study basically if the universe expanded, so the scale factor changed in your FRW's cosmology, so that actually results in something like Hamiltonian, which is like frequency dependent, time dependent Hamiltonian, and so you have some particle creation during inflation. So you will study that in your tutorial tomorrow, so let me now do the similar thing for a quantum mechanical thing. I have to define one more thing. So I want to talk about correlation functions. So before the example, sorry for that. Correlation functions. And you simply define them as what happens if you are in vacuum with the fields, and then you can have a number of them. And so, of course, if I take just one of those, explicitly EG, so if you have just one of them, what are you getting? Five. Okay, so if so, remember that whenever you have just one correlation function, it's given by zero. But if you have two of them, that's called variance again. And it basically tells you, you know, how big the fluctuations of the field are in a given vacuum. Q of t and Q of t. So again, you can plug in the expression in terms of the in-basis. So from now you expand the Q in terms of the in-basis because you know how the creation and annihilation operators act on this zero vacuum. And so it's just, you have to expand this quadratic relation. And what you find is that it's actually equal to F in of T square. Okay. So this is a particular interesting correlation function which tells you, you know, how big fluctuations of the field are in the given vacuum. Okay, so now that promised example of particle creation. So, example of particle creation and so you want to simplify your life as much as you can. So I'll basically have constant frequency all the way up to zero. And at zero, I'll just jump to another frequency. So I'll just have, you know, jump in frequency. So this is your omega of t. Omega of t just looks like it has some value here, omega n. And it has a different value here. And there is a jump in frequencies at time equal to zero. So in other words, your omega of t can be written in terms of the theta functions as omega n theta of minus t and then plus omega out theta of t. And theta is this function which is 0 and 1. Over there, okay? So this is my profile of the frequency. And so now let's ask how many particles are produced in this setup. So for that, we need to really find what these in modes and what these out modes are. And once we find what these in modes and what these out modes are, then we can calculate this beta square. So we can relate them and find alpha and beta, and you can see how many particles are created by this beta square here. Okay, so now you can sort of guess the solution. So if you have f in, so f in has to behave as prescribed over there in the infinite past. And in the infinite past, you know that, you know, you have this omega n frequency. So in the infinite past, it really has to look like this. 1 over 2 omega n square root of that e minus I omega n and t. And because the frequency is not changing, so we know how omega n, how fn looks like here. But because the frequency is not changing all the way up to zero, it must be still the same solution. So this will be true for theta for times which are negative. Okay. So now in the future for positive times, your frequency is again constant. And so you immediately know what the basis of solutions are. So the solution of your equation of motion is again, you know, given by these exponentials, but now with omega out. Okay. But in principle, you can have both of them. You can have plus I omega out or minus I omega out. Okay. So in the for t bigger than zero, we will have theta of t, and then you will have times 1 over 2 omega out. And then in principle, you can have both solutions. So A times minus I omega out T and B times E plus I omega out N T. Okay, so still solves the equations of motion, and I can put both of them, and I have A and B are some constants which are to be tuned. Okay, so now this must be true. And you can find what is A and B are by requiring that F in is actually nicely behaved, meaning that it's continuous, and its derivative is continuous. Okay, so requiring continuity of F and M prime, F prime, you can actually fix what these A and B's are. But you know, see that F in is really a solution for all the times. Okay, so from here, of course, this imposes two conditions, that F is continuous everywhere, in particular in zero, and F prime is continuous everywhere, in particular in zero. If it were not, then of course my equation of motion is not well defined. Okay, so then you can find that A is minus 1 over 2 times, this is pain, omega in, omega out. It's like if you are doing some basic quantum mechanics, right? And then omega in, omega out, plus, there's plus in between them. And then B, there's a minus. So B is 1 over 2 times omega in, omega out, and then omega out minus omega in. Okay. Very good. So now we have the in mode. So now, of course, you can do the same thing for the out mode. So the out mode, the only thing you know that in the infinite future, it has to behave like 1 over 2 omega out exponential minus I omega out t. Okay, so f out for t bigger than 0, it must behave like 2 omega out e minus I omega out and t. That's required by your condition of the out mode. But in the past, it can have, in principle, both ways, if you want. So plus theta of minus t. And then I can have a linear combination minus I omega in t plus d times plus I omega in times t. And again, requiring continuity, you can find what c and d are. And so let's think omega out plus omega in to omega. There's two here, and then omega in, omega out, and d is the same thing, but now, oh no, there's a minus here. So it's omega in minus omega out. Plus. Okay, so now you have found your in modes and out modes. Yes?
For the F in calculation, we had a 1 on square root 2 omega out in front of the terms capital A and B, but not in the out mode calculation.
Sorry, so we had what?
The prefactor before the bracket involving the capital A and B, the 1 on 2 square root omega out, that's not there in the F out calculation. Should it be there?
Sure.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. That's the omega in, right? So, yeah.
difference. Other mistakes? Did we found any other mistakes here? Okay, so now we have the modes f in and f out, and so the last thing is basically to express how you write f out in terms of f in. So we want to write f out in terms of alpha f in plus beta f in star. And so you know how to write these alpha and beta in some sense, and they are given by your scalar product, by the formula I wrote yesterday. And so we can write these, what these alpha and beta are, okay? And in particular, you find that alpha is omega in plus omega out divided by 2 times omega in, omega out. And beta is just a minus sign in between. Okay, so that's the pain you have to go through. But now you can basically answer all the questions. So first, you can tell how many particles are there in the infinite future. So an out is respect to the in vacuum. It's of course beta square. And so it's just this thing square. So it's omega I and minus omega out square divided by 4 omega in omega out. As a quick check, if omega in equals to omega out, I haven't changed the frequency at all, and so I shouldn't be creating any particles. And indeed, if omega in equals to omega out, you are getting 0. So that's telling you that it's probably correct. You can also calculate all the correlation functions. So for example, you can calculate the variance here, and you can calculate what, you know, how much the thing is fluctuating. And it's given by f in square. So you just have to take the painful formula here and square it, and you get some result. And you get the fluctuations of the field, or how big the fluctuations of the field are in the in vacuum. And that's, of course, non-trivial quantity. Yeah?
The last thing means that when I decrease the energy of the mode by something, by a joule, then I get some number of particles. But if I increase it, I also get same number of particles.
Of course.
That's funny.
Well, why is it funny? So we are sort of... Yeah. Well, you sort of do not...
You've got to be able to erase it, right?
You also have the bottom, the denominator gets...
Get rid of that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, if you swap omega in and omega out, it would be the same number of particles.
Right.
Yeah, you just swap the value of those, and but I think, yeah, that's sort of expected, because you sort of are not... I'm tempted to say that you are not recognizing whether you are creating the particles with the positive frequency or negative frequency in some sense. But maybe that's not the reason, so I would have to think about it a little bit more. But anyway, so this is the mass which you are getting out. And so this should be the number of particles. And in some sense, you should be creating them in both cases. Yeah. Anyway, so you will do this calculation again, but now, as I said, in the framework of field theory. So you will really calculate how many particles are produced during inflation of the FRW spacetime. So I did the simple part for quantum mechanics, but now you will do the more complicated one in terms of field theory. So maybe I don't delete this thing here yet. So far we have been doing just quantum mechanics. Okay, so now, however, it's very straightforward to do it for field theory as well. So what I would like to discuss, and I still have 15 minutes, which is great, is a famous famous effect, which is called Unruh effect. And so Unruh effect describes how actually different observers, even in Minkowski space, how different observers see really different number of particles. And in particular, you know that in Minkowski vacuum, the observer who is like the natural observer in Minkowski vacuum doesn't see any particles. However, if the observer starts accelerating, then actually they suddenly see a thermal bath of particles with some temperature, which is proportional to the acceleration. Okay, so let me just very briefly discuss this effect. And for that, actually, we'll just be doing the analogs of these two blackboards on the left. But now for the fields. So let's call it Unruh effect. So now you'll be doing exactly the same thing as we were doing for the harmonic oscillator, but now for a field. So the simplest one is the scale field, okay? So consider scalar field. And of course, in general, so in curved space, there is no preferred time in some sense. But you can always split your space-time into some time, well, if the topology permits, but you can split it into time slice and the rest of the thing. So splitting, and you can do it covariantly, sort of covariantly, but anyway, so splitting to time t and the rest and spatial coordinates x, you can write down the solution. So now you define, of course, some kind of Lagrangian density which defines your theory. So you start with some action there. And then you write down the equations of motion for that field. And then you expand the solution of these equations of motion again in some basis. Okay, so you, in particular, write your field, which now depends on x and t, and it's advantageous to write it in the momentum space. So you write it as d3 of k, and then some coefficients of expansion, ak, and the solution, phi k x of t, which is a solution of classical equations of motion, and ak dagger phi k x of t. Okay, in some sense, this is just the analog of writing q as af and a dagger f star. Okay, but now I'm just writing that in the momentum space in some sense. So for each k, I have what I had before. So again, these things in flat space, you would just take them as e minus I omega t plus kx. This is what you would, minus I omega t, whatever, something like that. But in curved space, it is not so. So in curved space, this will be some different basis, again, which is like the full basis of solutions in some sense. But it's not necessarily this one. And in fact, you can write this one only if you have killing vector t and if you have killing vectors x. In all other cases, you cannot do it. So this is some complicated basis. Some complicated basis. Okay, so now we expanded that, so we have analog of the q hat here. Second thing is to introduce the corresponding scalar product. Okay, so in our case, the scalar product was just given by this Wronskian here. So now you'll have the same scalar product, but in some sense, just for each x in the spacetime. So if you vary x's, you have different scalar products. So you define the scalar product phi 1 and phi 2 to be okay. So you have the splitting on time and space. So you integrate over any Cauchy surface, so over your surface of t equal to constant time, d minus 1 x, and there is the corresponding determinant, h. And you have to define it covariantly. So n mu, so this is my splitting, so this is t equal to constant slice, and x's live on that t equal to constant slice, and this is my normal to that slice, n mu. So n mu, and then phi 1 star d mu phi 2, and then minus d mu phi 1 star, and then phi 2. Okay? So specifically, if you choose n mu to be just 1, 0, 0, 0 in your coordinates, the time coordinate, then this just becomes dt. And so what stands here is just phi 1 star dt phi 2, and then dt phi 1 star phi 2, which is precisely what we have here. But now what you do is you just integrate it over the whole space, over the whole spatial slice. OK, so that's your scalar product. And so similarly, you require that your modes phi k, so before ff was equal to 1, so now you require that this phi k prime is actually just delta function. That's the analog of 1. So you require that phi k mode is normalized by delta k minus k prime. Well, whatever, d. Okay, so you require that. So now you start quantizing. So you promote these guys to operators. You introduce the vacuum. You can create particles of given k, and so on. So everything proceeds the same way. In particular, you can also choose a different basis. You don't have to choose the basis phi k, but you can choose the basis phi bar k. And so the analog, again, of the table there, so my new basis. OK, so the old basis is given by, in three dimensions and four dimensions, alpha kl by l bar. I don't know why I defined differently, beta kl phi l star. So this is my new basis. This is my old basis. And I can relate them by this Bogoliubov transformation. So these are my Bogoliubov coefficients. So in particular, your beta kl is given by minus phi l star and phi k bar. And similarly, you can find what alpha is. Okay, and then you have, again, a particle creation, if you want. So the particles observed by one observer will be different from the particles observed by the other observer. In particular, if you have 0 defined by the basis phi, and then you calculate how many particles are there in the basis phi bar, so then you just apply the number operator. You again find that this is given by beta kl square. Okay, so you know, just think about it as precise analog of what's happening here. Yes.
Two questions. In the harmonic oscillator case, we didn't have the I in front of the scalar product.
Okay. So I hope the I is correct there, and it should. So let's see. Let's keep the I there for the moment. And let's see if it actually gives whatever we need to get. So we will, as we will do the FRW spacetime, we will consider the scale field in FRW spacetime. And then we will split the scale field into the time-dependent part and the spatial-dependent part. And we shall see that the time-dependent part should obey precisely the same scalar product. So it should be normalized with respect to 1 in that case. So let's keep the I there, and let's see if it really falls out so that the convention is the same. So what I'm saying is that what we will do is that we will do like phi is some like phi t, function of t, and then it will be I kx or whatever. And so what I require is that this phi t part is actually normalized equally as the harmonic oscillator. So that this phi will satisfy product scale phi equals to 1. And that should follow from the scalar product here for the whole thing. So let's see if it does. And if it doesn't, then you'll have to alter the definition. Okay?
Okay. Second question is, so the Bogdanov transformations are allowed to take particle zonodes from one frequency and put them into another frequency, right?
In principle, yes. In practice, it doesn't happen. It may not happen, but in principle, you may allow that, right? That you take some frequency to another frequency.
Is there a simple physical reason when that would happen? Like what type of expanding spacetime?
It's a good question. I don't know. Hmm. I don't know. So in our case, which we'll study, I think tomorrow. It probably doesn't happen. So I don't know. In general, people write beta KL because in principle it could change the momentum.
Probably also depends on which coordinates x you choose. Because if you rescale,
exactly. So I would say as long as you have something like killing coordinates x, you cannot really change the momentum. But once you start messing with that, once your x coordinates are no longer killing vectors, then probably it will change. Oh, very good. So that's the answer. Other questions? Yes?
Yeah. Do you call D the space-time dimension of the object space?
So here, D was space-time dimensions. Sorry, I just put D minus 1. Let's put 3.
Space-time.
So D was the number of space-time dimensions. And so here, what you are integrating over is this Cauchy surface sigma, where you sort of choose t equal to constant time, d equal to constant slice. And so you are integrating over that spatial slice. OK, we have 2 minutes for undo effect. So. This is basically precise analog of what we are doing for the harmonic oscillator. So now let us consider an accelerated observer in Minkowski space. So accelerated. Just take two-dimensional Minkowski. If you do four-dimensional Minkowski, there is not really any difference. So you know that if this is my Minkowski T and X, then the accelerated observer does sort of like this thing here. And you know from your GR course that actually he has sort of like two horizons. So he cannot basically. There's one horizon t equal to x, and there's another horizon t equal to minus x or whatever. Okay, so now you can relate, so you can describe the trajectory of this observer. And this observer can carry some coordinates which are adapted to what he sees. So these are usually denoted by t bar and x bar. So this is the accelerating observer. And he uses coordinates t bar and x bar. And these are related by sine h and cosine h of your thing. So the Minkowski coordinates t is given by 1 over a, and then e to a x bar, and then sine h a t bar, and x is 1 over a, e to a x bar, and cosine h a of t bar.
One question?
Yeah.
Why do we have the n1 integration over x in the like f1, f2?
Why do we have what?
Why don't we have like integral over x?
Well, you want this to be a nice scalar product. So,
I mean, like if you are integrating over 2 minus 1 dimension, d minus 1 dimension, then there we are in 2 dimensions, so we should integrate like x.
We are 4 space-time dimensions, right?
Well, there you are in 1 dimension in some sense. You have 0 spatial dimensions there, so you're not integrated.
0
spatial dimensions. Sure, sure. Your Q is a field. Right, so Q is a field, and it's a function of time and space, but there's no space.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, maybe we should stop here because there's not enough time to do it. Well, I'll just give you the result. So, these coordinates, T bar and X bar, are basically, they describe, so this is X bar equal to 0, this is x bar equal to something else. So you have all these things here. So this is x equal to constant thing, and this is t equal to constant. Okay. And so another t equal to constant will be this guy, another equal to, and a is the acceleration of the observer. So a is the magnitude of the acceleration. Okay, so now it's not surprising that the observer is using different modes, the accelerated observer is using different modes than the Minkowski observer. The Minkowski observer will be using the modes phi k, which are proportional to e to I omega t minus kx, where these are the Minkowski things, and the accelerated observer is using phi k bar, which is I omega t bar minus, okay, so this is in 2 dimensions, k x bar. Okay, so he is using his coordinates to define preferred modes, and the Minkowski observer is using his coordinates to define his modes. Okay, so now the last thing is that you go through all this, and so what you have to find is how, you know, these modes are related to each other. And so you have to calculate this coefficient of beta. So you have to calculate the scalar product between phi L and phi bar K. Okay. So then the number of particles, if you want, as measured by the observer. So you have Minkowski vacuum, and then you have the accelerated observer using AK, bigger AK in Minkowski vacuum. And that's given by an integral dl beta kl square. And so all you have to do is basically calculate this beta kl, and it's given by the scalar product. And the scalar product is given by this. So you see that that's some integral which you have to do. But of course, the integral is quite nasty because the relation between the t and t bar and x bar are quite complicated. So when you are calculating the integral, actually you have to plug in these very complicated functions in some sense. Okay, so now this is really a nasty integral, and many people actually avoid doing that integral. And so they have some ways how to avoid doing that integral. But anyway, if you do that integral, what you find, this is just given by e to 2 pi k over a minus 1. Okay, so the number of particles observed by this accelerated observer in the Minkowski vacuum is actually both
Einstein distribution, if you identify the temperature to be A over 2 pi. So really, the accelerated observer sees a thermal bath of particles with the temperature proportional to his acceleration. OK? And so that's what is Annu effect, as the famous thing. So if you want, you can try to do that integral, but it's nasty. And so, for example, if you open the book Introduction to General Relativity by Carroll, he completely avoids doing this integral and has some dirty trick how to avoid doing that. So you will not see how that integral is calculated, but it will be calculated in Muganov's books. So Muganov has actually this approach. Okay, so let me stop here. And tomorrow we'll climb to base, to camp number 2, by actually quantizing a scalar field in a fixed FRW space-time.